Enemy Alien Control Program. The San Francisco News, March 7, 1942. Representative Carl Henshaw, Republican California, told the House today the administration must act speedily to evacuate all enemy aliens from the West Coast in preparation for a major attack by the Japanese on Hawaii with sabotage on the Pacific coast. They found dying orchards at the Owens Valley Reception Center, a registration and an assigned home. Ancient mountains surrounded flimsy buildings of wood frame boards and tar paper in this enforced exodus. A barbed wire zone. Mio already missed the sounds of the ocean's rhythm, not allowed to speak Japanese or to leave the 5,000 acres. I was restless from mother's stress. She sang song of the cradle in whispers. Word has come to us. The Japanese timetable will bring the second phase of their plans into action about April 15th, Republican Representative Henshaw said. This includes a major attack on Hawaii and the commencement of sabotage action on the West Coast in preparation for events to follow. They found a first meal of mulligan stew, rice and beans with bread. What was this strange taste? Mother felt sick to her stomach. She could not find a doctor. I was distressed with this new diet. Food came from cans until cooks were assigned. Mother stood in line for an hour for each meal and then in line for a shower. Takumi brought blankets, linens, towels, toilet articles, soap, combs, knives, forks, spoons, plates, bowls, and cups. He was given an army bed, one blanket, and one straw tick. Father winced as mother hung laundry on a rope. If our administrative officials do not get down to quick action to evacuate all Japanese and all other enemy aliens immediately, they may, by inaction, have committed so great a sin that even history may never forgive them. They found a limit war relocation area sign as the center became the Manzanar Relocation Center. Father was always aware of the 500 military police that stood guard. Mother worked in the garment factory. She liked the rhythm of the universal sewing machine as she altered World War I clothing to fit. Father used his skills in the sign shop. They earned a little money. A curtain hung was their room divider. I would imagine touching the wood dresser with a round mirror, the scent of cut roses from Rose Park, and a row of books. One photograph on the dresser reminded my parents of when they met by the sea. The snap as mother placed the plaid tablecloth on the small round table. I would listen to the sound of the round-faced clock. Mother tried to keep down the dust by watering around the barracks. I would feel my mother's fear when father snuck out of the confinement of camp by crawling under the barbed wire. He avoided the searchlights in order to fish in a quiet stream. For a few moments, he did not feel like an enemy.
From the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, Pacifica Radio, this is host Lois P. Jones, and welcome to Poets Cafe. Our guest, Cindy Rennie, expresses story through mixed media, bringing myth to life in contemporary context. She's the author of Mapless with Nakia Cheney, Moon of Many Petals, Listen to the Codex, Breathe in Daisy, Breathe out Stones, Quiet Lantern, Spider with Wings, and she co-authored Speaking Through Sediment with Michael Cooper. Cindy is a founding member of Poetry, an Inland Empire-based literary community, and a finalist for the 2016 Hillary Gravendick Prize Poetry Competition. Welcome, Cindy.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here.
Yeah. Wow. What an opening poem. We have a long history of racism in America, and the laws keep changing to accommodate our prejudices. I've noticed, you know, when you look back through the centuries, how they change laws for Mexicans, for indigenous people, Chinese people, Jews. And I was thinking how timely this book is, that you decided to work on Manzanar. And now there's so much attention, of course, being put on the separation of the children. So tell me about this project and how it evolved from thought into a beautiful, beautiful chapbook. Oh, and I'll also comment that some of the excerpts that you read, hopefully the audience, or listeners rather, will get that, but came from the news articles as well.
This story actually began with my art. So I'm a fiber artist, and I did a series, and part of that series, I think the first piece is actually on the cover of the book, and it had a figure of Japanese traditional shape with the kimono and of a geisha and a bird. And as I write, I discover who these people are and what happens. But in this case, the art was on my design wall, several pieces, and I heard tell our story. And I was quite surprised, because usually the art comes first, and I'll match poems to the art that have been written before, or it just never happened this way before. And I'm like, okay. And I have a Japanese pen pal. We've been pen pals for over 10 years, and we send fabric to each other. So I have her fabrics in a lot of these pieces. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe this will be based in Japan. Maybe it'll be based where she lives. I don't know. And so I get a lot of inspirations from my walks. And I took a walk one day, and I heard Manzanar and stillborn. So the narrator in this book is an unborn child. That's the I. And I thought, okay, I listened to the muse, and let's do Manzanar. And so there's a little bit in Japan, because that figure turned out to be unborn child's great-grandmother. There's past life visits in the story, and so it became part of the story. But mostly it's in Manzanar. And what happens when I write, I'm not conscious of this, but as I'm writing this book, it was the 75th anniversary of Manzanar.
Wow.
And so the timing just always works out like that. And then with what's happening in the country, I wanted to get this published quickly. I felt that it needed to be published, because as you know, it can take several years.
Sure.
Breathe In Daisy was 5 years from when it was accepted. And I just felt like I didn't want to wait 5 years. And so it did get published fairly fast. And I was concerned that there would be something happening like this again in our country, but I never dreamed it would be children.
Yeah. Yeah. And the details within the book, for anybody that's listening, we're talking to Cindy Rennie. This is a gorgeous book called Moon of Many Petals, and it's published by Chola Needles. It's really not a novel. It's sort of a story in verse. I don't know if that's kind of unusual for you to do something like that.
It's my second one.
Okay.
Quiet Lantern is my first one, and it was based in Hue, Vietnam.
Oh, wow. Okay. So the stories come to you, and the characters dictate what they want, and maybe even what they want to say. And woven within this collection are images of the actual fiber art that you've done. Glorious. Oh, my God.
Thank you. These are
so beautiful. I've seen them up close. And they detail, or they reflect the story, right?
Yes.
For example, let's look at the next one, which is Orphan. And this one even has text on it. So our listeners, you know, you can't see this, but you can go to the website and probably see it.
Yes.
It's gorgeous colored. It looks like autumn, and there's some kind of poem or text woven into this fabric. There's tree. Does the poem come first, or did the fabric art come first?
The fabric art came first in this book, and for me, it worked out. I don't feel like they're just illustrations. They go alongside with or add to or bring something different. This particular piece is actually a Japanese garden that's located in Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, you know, that flavor to it. But this was done before the book was an idea even. So the publisher selected some of the images, and I selected some.
Okay.
And so it was interesting to see what he put with which poems. Mm. And really the changes that I made was new work that went specifically with this story that he didn't know about were the changes I made.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, this is host Lois P. Jones. We're with our guest Cindy Rennie on Poets Cafe, and we're talking about her amazing chapbook that takes place in Japan and then moves to Manzanar. Why don't we delve a little bit more into the book and hear something?
Okay,
next.
This is Orphan. One, Mio remembered a man appeared like a tiger of sharp teeth and round eyes to buy their house for a low price. 6 months pregnant, she and Takumi had an hour to grab what they could carry, gathered what they could see. How long would they be gone? Where would they be uprooted to? The scrap of indigo fabric Takumi had dyed, one love letter, a doll to offer the goddess for a child, an origami butterfly Natsumi, her grandmother, had folded, and a few clothes scrambled into two suitcases, didn't prepare Mio for a place of dust. Two. Neighbors yelled, "Japs, go back to where you came from." "Our friends fear us," said Takumi. "You dared to bomb our country. Will you kill us in our sleep?" Takumi shielded Mio as they left for the safety of blacked-out windows on the bus. Three. Beyond was a house constructed for all the orphan children of Japanese descent. Their cries stormed the bus like an elephant trumpeting in yellow dust.
So the house was where?
So I located my family in Morro Bay, and they were, you know, fine with their neighbors and part of the community. They weren't allowed to become citizens until the 50s. So they were just
wow.
Here in America. So the sea is part of the story all the way through, because even though you can be forced to be moved away, home still within you. And so Mio has dreams of the sea, and I like to do magical realism. So she's decorating the barracks with starfish. I mean, these things weren't really happening, but these were ways that she tried to keep the connection to home
right.
in her mind.
And it's also elemental as it relates to the unborn
yes.
child in the womb. So the water carries the theme as well.
But some interesting things in this poem, even though I write about other cultures, there's a lot of me in here.
Mm-hmm. We can't keep ourselves
you
out.
We can't. And so in 2003, I lost my house in San Bernardino to fire, and I had an hour.
Mm.
And
mm.
so I thought about, what did I grab? So what would they grab? And there's another poem in the book that goes into the four items in detail and what they meant to Mio.
Mm-hmm.
And so just having those experiences, it's not the same as being forced, but in a way the fire forced me out
of
my house.
Yeah.
And then part two about the neighbors, I found out from a friend that her mother started, you know, being afraid of the Japanese because our government was putting out so much propaganda, but mm-hmm. originally they were friends, and she was not a racist at all.
Well, this is how it happens.
And this is how it happens.
You know, and the government puts out the propaganda, and the news feed machine, and the fear is generated, and then these changes come about.
And the third part, which fits today.
Horrific laws are enacted.
They took orphans from institutions like the Salvation Army mm-hmm. and all. They were Japanese, and they put them in the camps. I mean, babies,
oh
toddlers.
Yeah.
So I had to put that in the poems.
And two-thirds of the people that were interred, the Japanese, were American citizens, which is another layer of injustice. And
not one was found guilty of being a traitor.
But didn't they have to sign their commitment to
yes.
being like a citizen? And if they didn't, they would be considered blacklisted in some way.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Even though they were treated like crap and put in an internment camp, they had to sign their loyalty to the U.S., you know. So Mio is the protagonist. And so, well, they're actually Mio, and there's Takumi, the husband. And then the third element is the unborn child. She's never named, right?
No.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect. But she has a lot to say because she's narrating and she's perceiving all of these changes that are happening with the mom.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, because, I mean, I'm a mom and I believe, and it's some people say, you know, that they can hear and they feel. And I sang to my child at the beach, you know, just this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I, you know, believe it makes a difference. So I felt that, you know, the unborn child could have a voice.
My ex-husband said to his mother, "Why did you drink cold water when I was in your stomach?" I always thought that was amazing.
I have a poem about that.
Do you really?
I do.
Okay, do you want to read it?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's at the beginning, before they've been moved. And it's short. "A quiet light. As the autumn sun hid, Mio said, 'I am pregnant.' Takumi's eyes grew large. 'We're going to have a baby,' he shouted. Mio could not handle breakfast of miso soup with rice, eggs, fish, and pickles. She craved mochi, but it is cold, and the womb is meant to be warm. Willow leaves fell, so tired, desolate. She walked by the cypress and sea otters in the chill of dawn, said good morning to a covey of quail. They dashed into the wind-blown grasses."
Hmm. Great. Yeah, it's right there. There's another poem. Is this from the perspective of the child, Wax and Ash? Because that's what I got from it. But I don't know if that's the grandmother or who did you have in mind, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm really not certain about that.
Okay.
One. This poem was inspired by a piece of art that I saw in Santa Monica, and this poem is collaged, like my art, with a lot of different perspectives. But in the book, I is the the unborn child.
Right.
That is consistent.
Yeah, so,
so
that's what I was thinking. All right. Would you mind reading that one?
"Wax and Ash. During the night, I looked into your body. Three crows cawed before mountains of wax. They said, 'Do not worry about anything.' Much later, a young hawk intoned a soprano voice, painted out the words in absence of bone stuck in amber. Now ash on your forehead, broken needles sacrificed for couched gold thread, amaratsu embroidered sticks and cold mums on kimono sleeves. A cloud circled you like a ring of smoke, half moon plucked dead blooms."
Wow, so powerful. If you're just tuning in, this is host Lois P. Jones. We're with our wonderful guest, Cindy Rennie, and she's reading from her book, Moon of Many Petals, as we're moving through the story of Manzanar and the unborn child that goes with its mother from Japan to Manzanar and what happens peripherally, internally and externally. Go ahead.
Well, actually, the mother moves from Morro Bay to Manzanar.
Oh, okay. So, but Japan is the beginning of the journey, though, right?
It is.
Okay.
Because Mio's grandmother is Natsumi, and that's who's in the artwork.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she's in Sendai from the past.
Right.
When I tried to find a time when the geishas were treated well and had more power in Japan, mm-hmm. to place Natsumi. And so there's past life visitations, and that's where the connection comes in.
Yeah, it just feels very much a part of that, the journey and the imprint that continues on through to and through in Manzanar. And you actually went to Manzanar.
Yes, I went in 2017 in June. Mm-hmm. Which usually it's cooler, but it decided to be 106 last year. And so I got to experience the hot winds, the dust, and being, they've, you know, built one barrack and inside the barrack, and it's stifling. They weren't, they didn't have air conditioning.
No.
And
initially, they just had cloths to separate them.
They had cloths,
them, right?
And the floor slats, the dust came into the floors.
And the bugs.
And bugs.
Yeah.
So I felt like, for a moment, I got to really experience the summer. Of course, winters are freezing.
Right.
But to experience that heat, I think if it had been a pretty day looking at Mount Whitney, it would have been a totally different experience, even though I feel their presence. And it was important for me to put my feet there.
Mm-hmm. And you also had another experience where you could connect with some of the elements that were actually there in Manzanar. You went to university.
Yes. So as I mentioned before, last year was the 75th year of Manzanar. And so there were a lot of, readings. There was a big celebration, if you want to call it that, coming together in L.A., where they actually represented many cultures and things that are happening against many cultures and religions in America. But that was in Los Angeles. So I live near Cal State San Bernardino, and they had a panel, and it was several children of their parents were in Manzanar, and they were sharing some of the stories. And it's very important, and I know it's being logged, the stories, because these people are dying, but also in the culture is a lot of shame with this, and their parents wouldn't talk about it. So it took, even in this instance, a long time for these adult children to get any of the stories. Mm. And so they were sharing the stories, and they also brought...
It's our shame,
but they carry it.
Yeah, I understand.
And they brought the yearbook from there. They had the original posters and different things that I'm not sure that they have in Manzanar, but I did not see it when I was there. Yeah. I didn't see the yearbook, and I was able to look through it, so I was able to handle it, that's how I was able to get the room and what it looked like, because I saw the actual pictures from that time. They weren't easy to access for me.
Sure. So having these, real-life elements actually adds to the richness to the story and to your own experience.
Well, that's where I found out about the father, the first poem at the end where he went under the gate. One of their fathers had done that, went outside the camp to fish.
Yes.
To have some freedom. And this really did happen. And I met someone recently who brought that up, and I'm like, oh, it's in my book. So some people knew about it, but
that's
I didn't
powerful.
Before.
Yeah.
Just that symbol of freedom.
There's a little quote from Hakuro Waku. I'm just going to read it really quick because that sort of resonates that same idea. Even the croaking of frogs comes from outside the barbed wire fence.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And there's some poems where the swallow, who becomes a character throughout the book, Mio says, well, you can fly away outside of the gate, the barbed wire also.
Mm-hmm. And trying to keep that perspective of freedom within the confinement and knowing that they're out in nature. And I noticed also with some of the photographs I was looking at, Ansel Adams went there initially and took a bunch of photographs, and he couldn't really get the people to represent how they felt. They wanted to all be smiling and showing a kind of facade that everything was okay and they were maintaining. And I think this speaks a lot to, their pride and their natural sense of face. And later on, I guess there were other people that were able to document it and represent it more.
Yes. Well, part of that is Ansel Adams was hired by the government, and so he's documenting. Dorothea Lange was also hired by the government, but she was capturing more of the real story.
Right.
Not that there weren't any smiles, but they confiscated her negatives.
Oh, my God. Okay,
because
I didn't know that part.
They didn't like what she was, I quote her in
the
here.
The truth. Yeah.
She was speaking the truth, and they didn't want to portray that. So fortunately, they didn't destroy them. So I have a book, and there's books out now of those photographs.
Right.
So he didn't really photograph, like, the guard tower and those kinds of places. Things. He wasn't allowed to do that.
The incriminating evidence. So we're running out of time, and I'd love if you could take us out with the last poem in the book.
Soul-consoling tower, graves, another, and still another on the ground, Utenchi Agara. I clap for the dead between the horse and the snake. Ishikori Dome guards the stonemasons. Outside, stories inscribe, remain, as sun slices memorial obelisk in half.
Thank you, Cindy. This is host Lois P. Jones, and our guest has been Cindy Rennie. Thanks to our producer, Marlena Bond. Look for us on the Poets Cafe fan page on Facebook. You've been listening to Poets Cafe on Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond. Thank you.